Well, hello. My name is James Lever, and this June marks the 110th anniversary of the first publication of T.S. Eliot's The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock in Harriet Monroe's magazine Poetry, after a little bit of lobbying from Ezra Pound, where it was first printed in the June 1915 edition of Poetry. And here it is, read by the actor Freddie Fox.
The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels, and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. Streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. The yellow fog that rubs its back upon the window panes, the yellow smoke that rubs its muzzle on the window panes, licked its tongue into the corners of the evening, lingered upon the pools that stand in drains, let fall upon its back the soot that falls from chimneys, slipped by the terrace, made a sudden leap, and seeing that it was a soft October night, curled once about the house and fell asleep. And indeed, there will be time for the yellow smoke that slides along the street, rubbing its back upon the window panes. There will be time. There will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create. And time for all the works and days of hands that lift and drop a question on your plate. Time for you and time for me. And time yet for 100 indecisions and for 100 visions and revisions before the taking of a toast and tea. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. And indeed, there will be time to wonder, do I dare? And do I dare? Time to turn back and descend the stair with a bald spot in the middle of my hair. They will say, how his hair is growing thin. My morning coat, my collar mounting firmly to the chin, my necktie rich and modest, but asserted by a simple pin. They will say, but how his arms and legs are thin. Do I dare disturb the universe? In a minute there is time for decisions and revisions which a minute will reverse. For I have known them all already. Known them all. Have known the evenings, mornings, afternoons. I have measured out my life with coffee spoons. I know the voice is dying with a dying fall beneath the music from a farther room. So how should I presume? And I have known the eyes already, known them all. The eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase. And when I am formulated, sprawling on a pin, when I am pinned and wriggling on the wall, then how should I begin to spit out all the butt ends of my days and ways? And how should I presume? And I have known the arms already, known them all. Arms that are braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight downed with light brown hair. Is it perfume from a dress that makes me so digress? Arms that lie along a table or wrap about a shawl. And should I then presume? And how should I begin? Shall I say, I have gone at dusk through narrow streets and watched the smoke that rises from the pipes of lonely men in shirt sleeves leaning out of windows? I should have been a pair of ragged claws, scuttling across the floors of silent seas. In the afternoon, the evening sleeps so peacefully, smoothed by long fingers, asleep, tired, or it malingers, stretched on the floor here beside you and me. Should I, after tea and cakes and ices, have the strength to force the moment to its crisis? But though I have wept and fasted, wept and prayed, though I have seen my head grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter, I am no prophet, and here's no great matter. I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker, and I have seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker. And in short, I was afraid. And would it have been worth it, after all, after the cups, the marmalade, the tea, among the porcelain, among some talk of you and me, would it have been worthwhile to have bitten off the matter with a smile, to have squeezed the universe into a ball, to roll it towards some overwhelming question, to say, I am Lazarus, come from the dead, come back to tell you all, I shall tell you all. If one, settling a pillow by her head, should say, that is not what I meant at all. That is not it at all. And would it have been worth it, after all? Would it have been worthwhile? After the sunsets and the dooryards and the sprinkled streets? After the novels? After the teacups? After the skirts that trail along the floor and this and so much more? It is impossible to say just what I mean, but as if a magic lantern threw the nerves in patterns on a screen, would it have been worthwhile if one, settling a pillow or throwing off a shawl and turning toward the window, should say, that is not it at all. That is not what I meant at all. No, I am not Prince Hamlet, nor was meant to be. I am an attendant lord, one that will do to swell a progress, start a scene or two, advise the prince. No doubt an easy tool, deferential, glad to be of use, politic, cautious, and meticulous, full of high sentence, but a bit obtuse. At times, indeed, almost ridiculous. Almost, at times, the fool. I grow old. I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I have heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me. I have seen them riding seaward on the waves, combing the white hair of the waves blown back. When the wind blows the water white and black, we have lingered in the chambers of the sea by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown, till human voices wake us and we drown.
Thank you very, very much indeed, Freddie. That was brilliant.
Thank you.
110 years on from when it was first printed.
Extraordinary.
Or no, not first written.
When it was first printed, you say?
Yeah.
Right.
It was first written, well, he was 21. He wrote it beginning in 1910, and he was 21, in Paris. and finished it in Munich in 1911. So 2122.
Oh.
I mean, one of the things that's so lovely about Prufrock's city into which he doesn't go is that in an Eliotic way, it's Paris and Munich and London, where he spent some time in 1911, and Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Boston, and St. Louis.
Mm.
You know, and you can hear glimpses of every one of those cities in this
absolutely
generalized town in which he doesn't go. What I should say is you memorize that rather than read from the page.
Yeah.
How does that affect your, I don't know, your relationship to the poem, or your relationship to reading it, or your freedom?
It changes everything. I wish I had been encouraged to do that more with poetry, because it's, you cross a Rubicon as soon as it becomes not the the first time you've learnt it within the first few days of the words being in your head, but after a week, 2 weeks of going over something that is embedding and percolating deeper and deeper and deeper, your understanding or your interpretation of what Eliot might have meant or what it means to you is suddenly cut loose, and you are able to freewheel with a word or the lilt of a word, or where a comma, a pause might go, and then you go back to the poem itself and go, oh, no, there's no comma written there, or there's no scissor written there.
Yeah.
And you can... It's like anything. If you learn it with all the rules in place, and then when it percolates and suddenly starts to deepen, and your personal connection and understanding of the poem suddenly starts to become profound, you can break the odd rule and freewheel just a little bit to make it make more sense for you. And for me, when I started reading it, it was a complete blur. I didn't understand a word of it at all, and I mean, gosh, maybe I still don't, but I feel like I understand it very, very well now as my version of that poem. And that is only thanks to learning it. Suddenly it became clear for me that it was two parts of a man's spirit talking to each other, and one pulling him one way, another pulling him another. Now, I'm not necessarily sure that's what Eliot intended, but that suddenly spoke to me. And I was suddenly able, having learnt it, to go, oh, there is a kind of, there's a narrative through line, however oblique and poetic, that I can follow, and I can get on that train of memory and take it through to its destination. And without doing that, I think a complex and really rich poem like this will always remain a bit in shadow for you.
Right, or you're on the outside of it. I mean, one of the things that makes this a very good poem to learn by heart, aside from the fact that it's relatively easy with Eliot, often because he's such a catchy poet, is that the you and I of the first line, one doesn't know whether Prufrock is talking to somebody else who he wants to go out to leave the room with, or to the reader, or, as you say, two different parts of his own self. And Prufrock is a fantastically internal, you know, nobody says anything. Prufrock doesn't say anything in this entire poem. This is a poem which exists within his head and is not necessarily a very good poem to perform, but a brilliant poem to remember.
Yeah.
Because it nothing passes his lips. It's whether I should say, or should I say, I am Lazarus come back. The only time when he actually seems to imply that he might say anything is he should have been an attendant lord.
Yeah.
Fit to advise the prince. And as soon as this version starts talking, it rapidly becomes the fool.
Yeah.
Full of high sentence, politic cautious, saying nothing.
When we were recording it, I had sort of inflected the line with a he feels himself a failure, which I'm, of course the poem is laced with all the way through anyway. But you said, no, what if the fool is something that is... It's not a negative thing. It's just an admittance of, you know, there's something more, there's something kinder in that reading that is on the recording than the one I'd originally imagined, and I far prefer that.
Well, it's the more, you know, both the fool as the laughable clown and the fool as in the Shakespearean character is always more intuitive, more intelligent than anybody else in the play.
Yeah.
If only he could open his mouth.
Yeah.
It's a perfect place for Prufrock to be.
Yeah.
In your head.
Yeah.
Not on the page. Or not really delivered to someone else.
That's right. And I think it's if that, like my dad, having had the four quartets in his head all his life, And my dad had lived with those poems, having been introduced to them by Michael Elliott in his late 30s. And so dad started work on these poems, again, much like me in reading Prufrock at the beginning, not understanding a word of what was said. But over time, over many years, the mists began to part. He began to sort of fight his way through the jungle to the point where much later in his life, in his 70s and into his 80s, he would take these works on tour and would perform them around the country. And if I stick at it now, by the time I'm my dad's age, I may have a half-decent stab at these very beautiful but complicated poems. So
you learn something because you don't understand it. You know, to have something which doesn't make any sense to you and to put it into a different part of your brain by memorizing it,
yeah,
gives you the patience to wait and not necessarily try too hard, you know, to storm the castle of understanding the poem. And, you know, maybe your father understands four quartets a little better, or maybe he understands it about the same as he has for 30 or 40 years. And eventually, maybe you come to a point where understanding the poem in the way that you first conceived understanding a poem, as in solving it, puzzling it out, becomes less relevant.
Absolutely.
What you have instead is the poem.
Yeah. As you say, it's not necessarily about understanding it in that sort of mathematical binary way.
Well, or literary critical sort of.
Yeah, it emerges over time, so long as it's in your brain, living in your soul and not on a page.
Yeah.
It starts to mean something to you with each passing year that's deeper and more interesting. And as you get, even though I'm reading it, or rather memorizing it and recording it closer to the age that Eliot wrote it, I will at some point become much closer to the age that Prufrock is.
Well, how old is Prufrock?
Well, I mean, I'd say he's past the half. I grow old, I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. In that sort of no man's land between 50 and 70, or 48,
right.
5 and 65, something like that. Midlife crisis.
midlife crisis territory. Crisis pretty early.
Yeah.
And he's losing his hair.
Yeah.
Which, you know. But yeah, in 1947, Eliot was in Harvard. And he read some poems, and he would be 59 or 58 in 1947. And let me play you what he said about this poem written by a 21-year-old.
Then again, one becomes rather out of touch with one's very early work. It's not as if it were written by someone else. That would be comparatively easy. But it seems to one to have been written by a young person with whom one is intimately and rather embarrassingly associated and of whom one is slightly ashamed.
I can quite understand that shame, in that it is one of the more embarrassing poems ever written.
Why do you say that?
It's tremendously self-exposing and tremendously vulnerable. It's written by a virgin,
yeah,
somebody who's tremendously sexually anxious and inexperienced and very, very fearful that his life may possibly end up Prufrockian. And the Eliot who wrote Prufrock was frightened and anxious about the possibility of becoming a successful academic philosopher in Harvard and living out his life in Boston in a way which was kind of laid out for him. Mm-hmm. And one of the funny things about Prufrock being printed in June 1915, I don't know what day of the month, you know, that they would have first read it, mm-hmm, is that Eliot got married on June the 26th, 1915. One of the reasons why Eliot did get married to an English woman was that it drew a line under the possibility of returning to America. It was something that almost forced his relocation across the Atlantic. I'm going to live in England and I'm going to be a poet.
To get away from the women who talk about Michelangelo.
To get away from, exactly.
And to lose his virginity and all those things that, you know, he was. I mean, I'm assuming the marriage was not a successful one.
No, it was one of the unhappiest marriages on both sides you could possibly conceive.
Yeah, formulated for the wrong reasons.
My marriage brought my wife no happiness, said Eliot. It brought me the state of mind out of which the wasteland emerged. So that's not a description of, you know.
It's not Lake Como and the sunset.
It's not Lake Como and the sunset. But it did prevent him from becoming J. Alfred Prufrock, and prevent him from becoming a Bostonian academic.
Yeah.
And there's a poem called The Boston Evening Transcript, which was also published in 1915 in November, which, Freddie, would you read this poem for us?
Certainly I will.
The Boston Evening Transcript. The readers of The Boston Evening Transcript sway in the wind like a field of ripe corn. When evening quickens faintly in the street, wakening the appetites of life in some, and to others bringing The Boston Evening Transcript, I mount the steps and ring the bell, turning wearily, as one would turn to nod goodbye to La Rochefoucauld if the street were time, and he at the end of the street, and I say, Cousin Harriet, here is the Boston Evening Transcript.
Oh, God, it's depressing, isn't it?
Yeah. Again, like Prufrock, there is a turn on a stair, which is a very Eliotic move.
Indeed. This image of corn is just sensational, isn't it? Which he is, of course, a sheaf, or swaying in the wind, that is at some point going to be cut down by someone with a scythe. And you get this sense of monocultured people with monocultured papers, with monocultured thoughts and monocultured train routes into work and out of work. And it's desperate. And I think, against what I love Prufrock, and why I really enjoyed being introduced to that poem by you, Boston Evening Transcript, is that we all, at different times in our lives, whether we're teenage, I remember saying to my humanities PSRE teacher at school, my mission by the age of 17 is to have had sex, you know, the terror of that not happening. And then later in life, you go, I just don't, desperately don't want to be mediocre. I don't want to be an also-ran. I don't want to be another sheath of corn. I want to be a weed growing up through it all. And it speaks so beautifully to that, because I don't know that that fear ever quite leaves.
But you're right. It's a very youthful fear.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, Harriet Munro, who began the magazine Poetry, where Prufrock was first published, she was terrified of future anonymity, of dying without being celebrated. She was a minor poet and a good critic. Or The Dead is probably the most mature story in Dubliners. It's written by an incredibly precocious, about 24-year-old, I'm not sure about that, but around 24-year-old, about Gabriel Conroy, about a middle-aged man finding out that he has wasted his life. Very similar to Prufrock's Terror, written by an incredibly precocious talent whose interest seems to have adhered to this particular fear of wasting one's life. And so, yeah, The Boston Evening Transcript is a poem trying very, very, very hard not to scream. There is a poem that Eliot wrote at Harvard called The Triumph of Bullshit, which was just basically is him screaming. Freddie.
The Triumph of Bullshit. Ladies, on whom my attentions have waited, if you consider my merits as small, etiolated, alembicated, orotund, tasteless, fantastical, monotonous, crotchety, constipated, impotent, gallimacious, affected, possibly imitated, for Christ's sake, stick it up your ass! Ladies, who find my intentions ridiculous, awkward, insipid, and horridly gauche, pompous, pretentious, ineptly meticulous, dull as the heart of an unbaked brioche, floundering versicles, feebly vesiculous, often attenuate, frequently crass, attempts at emotion that turn out isiculous, for Christ's sake, stick it up your ass! Ladies, who think me unduly vociferous, amiable cabotin making a noise that people may cry out, this stuff is too stiff for us. Ingenuous child with a box of new toys. Toy lions carnivorous, cannons fumiferous, engines vaporous. All this will pass. Quite innocent, he only wants to make chivalrous. For Christ's sake, stick it up your ass! And when thyself with silver foot shall pass, among the theories scattered on the grass, take up my good intentions with the rest. And then, for Christ's sake, stick them up your ass.
That's ass, not ass. Ass is a better vowel, I think.
Is the American, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
First coined, according to the OED, by T.S. Eliot.
Bullshit.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I'm not sure I completely believe that, but it's down in the dictionary as its first appearance in print.
Wow.
That this poem, which is an unsayable and unpublishable poem, to be handed around among friends, it has a relationship between its unsayability and Prufrock's unsayability, the interiorness of it. And the epigraph to Prufrock is from Dante's Inferno and is about Dante bumping into some guy, Guido de Montefeltro, who was a counselor to Pope Boniface. Mm. And he tells his story to Dante, and as long as it's not going to go to anyone. So the whole poem is set up to be, I'm only telling you this as long as it doesn't go any further. In other words, keep it in. And again, it's a really, really hard poem to... It's just not a poem where one could stand up and deliver to an audience with any sort of real conceptual logic.
Yeah, it's not Auden, is it? It's its own thing. And how interesting, because of course a 21-year-old, think of all the things that a post-pubescent teenager, more or less, doesn't want to be anyone to hear, almost everything. Yeah. But funnily enough, that has a correspondent moment in life towards the end where you go, do I want to share in my doubt and my failings? And I think that makes that silver thread from adolescence through to the coming of old age that Eliot was either very aware of consciously or subconsciously so.
Well, his greatest influence was the French poet Jules Lefort, who was born 1860 and died 1887, the year before T.S. Eliot was born.
Wow, yeah.
Just maybe in Eliot's mind, I don't know, compounding the sense of brotherhood with this French poet with whom he fell completely in love. And he would have encountered Jules Lefort in about 1909 and ordered the three-volume set of Lefort and be pretty much probably the only volume of Lefort in America. And so it's not just that influence that you meet as a young artist that changes everything for you. It's that influence that nobody else knows about, really. And the combination of Prufrockian ennui, Prufrockian anxiety about women, Prufrockian use of Hamlet as a metaphor, so much that formed the early Eliot is from Jules Lefort. So, Freddie, would you read Romance, translated recently by the poet and critic Mark Ford, by Jules Lefort for us?
A great pleasure.
Romance by Jules Lefort, translated by Mark Ford. Hamlet, to a nunnery, go. I've a thousand seabirds nesting in the upper reaches of my soul. They're pale and grey, and fill the dismal rooms with rhythms sharp as waves, as knives. They dirty everywhere with carcasses, with corals, seashells. Circling crazily, they crash into each other and into the bourgeois wainscoting of my soul. Pale birds, you who follow in the wake of ships, when my fiancée opens the door, make for her a necklace of shellfish, one that stinks of carrion, at which she will observe, this soul is rather too strong for my little nose, so I think not. But this beautiful necklace, can I keep it? Ah, poor thing. It will do her no good.
Oh. It's tough, isn't it? It's so beautiful. I love that poem. And having played Hamlet, there's obviously so many... There's so much that I wish I'd read that poem before I played the part, actually. And you can see the colours, you can taste it, you can smell that poem.
You can smell it, yeah. You know. Well, and from the seashore as well. And that Hamletian or Prufrockian mixture of misogyny, uncertainty as to what will happen if you open your mouth to a woman, and tender protectiveness as well. And Jules Le Fogg is great.
Oh, it's wonderful. And you get fear. I mean, real underneath all of that, fear of failure, fear of women, fear of not living up to some kind of expectation that's been set up for you. And of course, that's then translated by Eliot onto fear of mediocrity in life. But it's they're sad, they're minor key, and they're fearful. And yet underneath it, there's a human spirit desperate to be loved.
Yeah, and they're funny and they're sarcastic.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
they're trembling on the lip of saying, stick it up your ass.
Stick it up your ass, exactly.
And Eliot really, truly fell in love with Le Fogg and would say in later years that he was by far the greatest influence upon him. That there was no poet in Great Britain or America in 1908 who would have been any use whatsoever to a young poet starting out.
And ironically, did Le Fogg, who obviously died in his 20s, it sounds like to me, 20s or
27.
27.
Tuberculosis.
Right. Did he die unknown or known?
He was just beginning to sort of get going. So
right.
I think 1886 was like his best year for...
Wow.
He'd spent 5 years reading newspapers to the Empress of Prussia. It was a very interesting life. And then just before he died, he married an English woman. And things started looking up for Le Fogg, and then unfortunately TB killed the pair of them.
At the age of that everybody famous dies.
Oh yeah, 27.
The 27 club, yeah.
Can we have another one?
Of course.
Right. And Le Fogg wrote, I think, about 4 or 5 poems called Sundays, which I kind of like. This is one of them, Dimanche. Freddie.
Sundays by Jules Le Fogg, translated by Mark Ford. Hamlet. Have you a daughter? Polonius. I have, my lord. Hamlet. Let her not walk i' the sun. Conception is a blessing, but not as your daughter may conceive. Rain. Pointless rain. Emotionless rain falls into the river. Il pleut, bergère. Sunday is a rest day for the river. Not a barge moves upstream or down. Vespers ring out over town. The banks are deserted, dispiriting. Girls from the local boarding school pass. Oh, how deeply I pity them. Some already wearing their winter muffs. One, who has neither muff nor furs and is dressed all in grey, seems particularly miserable. Suddenly she breaks ranks and runs. Oh my God, what's got into her? She's going to throw herself into the river. And there's not a boatman, not a rescue dog in sight. Night falls, and the little port is lit up. Oh, it's all so recognizable. And the rain drenches the river, pointless, emotionless.
God.
That's great.
Isn't it? It's I mean, talk about boredom, but witty and sad again, as he witnesses a suicide or an attempt.
A successful suicide. There's not a rescue dog. I had to look it up. They did have rescue dogs by the rivers.
Yeah.
Newfoundlands.
Mm.
No, she's dead, but emotionlessly he cannot tear him. He's so numbly, teenagely bored. He simply can't move from the window. It reminds me of an attendant lord, I was just thinking.
Yes.
You get the word attendant, en attendant, a hell of a lot in Jules Le Fogg, waiting. Just waiting around. And now I feel the weight of the attendant lord, more waiting.
Yeah. And isn't it the most magnificent hard cut that he writes after she's gone into the river, not a rescue dog, anybody in sight, night falls. It's an amazing Kubrick-esque hard cut, isn't
it? Yeah. I mean, there is another poem called Dimanche, which begins, J'aurais passé ma vie à faillir m'embarquer, if you forgive the accent. I will have spent my life in failing to embark. And you just couldn't have a more Prufrockian line.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, in celebrating 110 years of the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, it's nice to just nod our heads to Jules Laforgue. And thank you for those readings.
Well, thank you very much, one, for giving me the impetus to learn Prufrock, which will stay with me forever, but also introducing me to the magic of Jules Laforgue. Thank you.
And thank you.